Hello, this is the Trimmed Down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m, and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life. From maybe that first track that they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest today is dancer and audio describer Bridget Crowley, who has just stepped down from describing dance and ballet after 20 years of travelling around the country, describing many productions from companies such as Scottish Ballet, Northern Ballet, Rombert and Matthew Bourne's New Adventures Company, to name just a few. In Bridget's Tracks of My Life, we will go on a journey from her early days as a dancer, winning a highly commended dance prize, time as the head of the dance department at Arts Educational Schools in London, through to reflecting on her 20 years of describing dance and ballet productions for blind and partially sighted audiences. Hello, Bridget, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, Toby. Thank you very much for having me. Very exciting.
Oh, well, I hope so. Bridget, as a dancer and a describer of dance, music must play an important part in your life. And I wondered, how did you find it selecting your tracks?
Well, difficult, I think it always is on these occasions. But I think what I started with was not the music I remembered so much as the pieces that stood out in my mind, or people, or something like that, and then went on to the music from there. I feel I am part of the music almost. I'm one of the musicians in the whole procedure. And so therefore, I'm so much part of it that it's what I see, perhaps, that I remember.
Bridget, the first track you have chosen is one that I think you have danced in a competition, and I believe you may have been highly commended for it. And I wondered, what is the track and why have you chosen it?
And why was it? Well, it's the waltz from Les Sylphides, the waltz in G. And yes, this was at school. And we always, every year, had something called the Sylphide competition. Now, we are talking a long, long time ago now, and I don't think things like this happen much anymore. But we all had to dance the waltz from Sylphide, and then some of us were chosen for the big finale, as it were, the finals. And we had a group who were very elite and all set for the Royal Ballet. I wasn't one of them. I never wanted to go to the Royal Ballet. I wanted to dance everything and anything, from tap to ballroom to anything. But I was chosen for this finale, this final. And nobody could believe it, really. I was a bit of a loner at school too, and so I didn't talk about it much. I just got on and sort of got ready for it. And when I danced it, there was a huge roar of applause from the other kids in the school, which actually knocked me backwards because I wasn't expecting it. And then when I was commended, up went the roar again. Because one of the outsiders, one of the people who weren't the elite, had actually been mentioned in the Sylphide Cup. And when I audio described the red shoes for the Matthew Bourne Company, in the middle of that, they dance part of Les Sylphides, and they do it beautifully, but sending it up very, very gently. It is very funny and very moving, because it is all about how a company would have danced it in the 30s when I was born. And so it all linked up. And so that was my first choice. And I love it.
Hearing that piece of music drawing the red shoes, which was a fantastic production, did it bring back those memories for you?
Yes, except that even if I was commended, I couldn't have danced it as well as they did. But there were, and there were lovely moments in it where the leading dancer, they do a little rehearsal, a lighting rehearsal beforehand, and she dances the pas de deux with her fur coat because her premier dancer is too busy having a fag in the wings. So it's just wonderful, yeah. So taking me back to the 30s and 40s and when I was at school, yeah.
Elsie Veed's Fair by Chopin, and fond memories of dancing and describing dance for you, Bridget, too. Your next track, Bridget, takes you back to the early 1980s, and I believe a time when you were head of the dance department at the Arts Educational Schools in London. What was it like being head of dance, and were you quite a tough head at all?
I think I was probably a bit of a pushover, really. No, I was very interested in the students as people always. I also had enormous sympathy for girls who were going to try to make a career in dance and clearly weren't going to make it. Either they weren't the right shape or just weren't made for sort of tough dance company life, because it is the toughest, it really is. I was very anxious that the shows we put on were really, really, really of a very high level, but I still wanted everybody to have a fair whack at it, if you know what I mean. But aside from that, I started a small dance company of my own for some of the students, not necessarily the best ones. Again, I suppose thinking back to me getting into the Silfied final when I wasn't expected to, I took dancers who I felt had a lot to offer but needed help to bring them out as performers, but also perhaps for them to make up their mind that the life wasn't for them. We went all over the country, little one-night stands at weekends and things like that, and I took a whole gaggle of them and some music students as well. I was very keen on them learning to dance to live music, which I think is very important and has been a sort of underrunning theme all through even my audio describing life. And we went to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. We were there for a whole month every year for 15 years.
Gosh.
And I could tell you, I think there's a book in that somewhere probably. But anyway, in 1982, it was the year of the Peruvian. Now, that was the year that, for some reason, the piece we did, one of the pieces we did was to Peruvian folk music. And we, again going back, when I had danced in Paris as a very young dancer, I had danced with a company which was a South American company, and I learned all the South American, what they call typique dances, not quite folk dances because that sounds a bit sort of bells and whistles, but really, really high. I mean, I did the Argentinian tango and some of the Peruvian peasant dances. And I went to Paris with two musician friends, and we heard another Peruvian company in a small concert hall. And we were all blown away with it and said, let's do something to that. And I researched a number of folk stories, and I sort of amalgamated them. And we did the story of the young boy who is carried away by an eagle on the eve of his wedding. And so I went back and used all my knowledge of the typique steps and movements and the atmosphere of it, this incredible, misty, mountainous feel. I can only describe it like that. It probably didn't look like that, I don't know. I remember the girls, at one point in the middle, they were in a circle, and they just had to, on the beat, shuffle, 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 without moving. They had shoulder to shoulder, just following each other round in a circle. And they said, that's not dancing, Bridget. Auntie Bridge, they used to call me. That's not dancing. That's just shuffling around. I said, you wait. I said, it speaks. It absolutely is what would have happened. And we sold out every night. So in the annals of Dancers Anonymous, 82, the year of the Peruvian, stands out. That's just says before Peruvian and after Peruvian, if you like. And so I've chosen the Las Incas version of El Condor Pass, which will give you the idea anyway, I hope.
Condor Pass Fair, and just hearing those rhythms, you can see people dancing. It sounds amazing. Your next track, Bridget, is from Swan Lake, which I think many people have seen in various different productions. And it has been performed in many different ways and many different interpretations as well. The part that you've chosen from Swan Lake is the Dance of the Little Swans. And I wondered, as somebody who's described many of those productions, how different each production is and how that makes it for describing each production.
Yes, I mean, yes, there are many. I mean, I must have described it for four or five different companies. And in some cases, they are following the tradition. I mean, it is one of the pieces that is very rarely altered because it's so famous. And it's iconic, almost, those four little swans going pas-de-cha, 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 releve across the stage. And if I'm doing it for one of the regular classical companies, we would have done a sort of workshop, hopefully, or even just a little chat about some of the steps that are used a lot, because I mean, there is a language to ballet, to classical ballet, and it's French. I don't know why pas-de-cha, which literally means step of the cat, is so called. But I haven't seen too many cats pas-de-cha-ing around, but they do leap about a bit, I suppose. But it is so iconic, this piece, that if you can't say pas-de-cha, 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 releve, which is what they're doing, I mean, if you just say tuck, jump, tuck, jump, tuck, well, A, it's harder to say, and B, it doesn't tell you exactly what, but you would have described exactly before you start what a pas-de-cha was, because it's used a lot in classical ballet. And we do, I mean, Northern Ballet in particular does a wonderful pre-show touch tour with Pippa Moore there. Well, she's just retired as their premier dancer, and she is now actually a describer, which is wonderful. But she would make sure that everybody in the audience who was at the workshop knew what a pas-de-cha, how it bounced up and down. She might even have helped them to do one. And we would be very careful to describe arms. When we did Swan Lake for Matthew Bourne, for instance, the very, very specific arm positions that the male swan perform right the way through it, you would describe to them at the workshop, or if there wasn't time for a workshop, then even at the end of the touch tour, you would take them on one side and say, look, we're going to use this phrase for this position, and we would have one of the company down to demonstrate and to help them to do it so that they knew what swans at rest were, and they knew what swan profile was, and they knew what swan crown was. And there were about five or six of them. So that you can come back to that like a sort of leitmotif, and every now and again they know exactly what that looks like, the audience. So coming to Matthew Bourne's, his Dance of the Little Swans is very, very different from those four young girls with their arms crossed in front of them going pas-de-cha across. There's the four little butch boys in their sort of fluffy white trousers, and they're very cheeky, and a lot of it is them learning. they sort of waddle in time to the music, you know, step, 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 and then there's a little bit where their arms flail and they skid on their heels as if they're trying to learn how to skid to land on the lake. But the other thing that happens in a classical company is that sometimes, very often, in fact, one of the principals is injured. And if your partner is injured and you're dancing a lead, very often your partner comes off as well because another couple go on because they've rehearsed together. And that can make huge differences. I remember once doing Swan Lake at the Albert Hall, and it was a huge production. It was, in fact, English National Ballet, but it was augmented with dancers from all over the place because it's done on the floor of the hall and it's enormous. And we had done a dry run and one performance with one couple, and nobody told us that it was going to be a different couple at the matinee. And when they came, they were a very, very, very eminent couple. And the whole thing became quite, quite different. And although they were doing marginally the same steps, in places they had their own choreography. And that you have to be very quick on to be. And if you don't know what you're talking about, that's hard. That's really hard. It's possible to do it, but it takes your breath away.
Bridget, as a dancer, I wondered how important you felt it was that somebody who's describing dance has some experience of dance, or maybe has been a dancer or ballet performer, to have that knowledge when they're describing.
I think it's absolute. It is possible to describe without it, but I think it is very, very important to me. I mean, it may be just because I'm coming it from that point of view, but it is a question of the musicality, of being part of the performance, that you understand completely how the body feels at the moment that you're describing. Your body, you have body memory. Perhaps if you can sing really well, because you're using your whole body. If you sing right from the core, and that's the important thing, I think.
The Dance of the Little Swans there from Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. Bridget, for your next track, we come to a Radiohead track, which is part of a Scottish ballet production, Ride the Beast. And I wondered, how difficult might it be when you're describing, when you've got a track like Creep from Radiohead, where the lyrics and the singing is part of the production?
Yes, well, we have to. We did, but it was difficult. What we did was to go back to drama describing rules, and on the whole, stop describing when Tom York was singing. You've got fabulous movement going on, and you want to describe it, but you can't get. You must not get into the way. So we cheated a little bit, because every time he came back to the repeats, I'm a creep, you would let that start, and then we could just pop in little bits here and there. The difficulty was that, in fact, the piece is absolutely brilliant, because this wonderful, gorgeous male dancer is dancing all the bits where he's saying, I'm a creep, I'm just puny and all those things. So you had to be able, in tiny little bits, describe the fact that actually the dancer is no creep at all. But I do remember also the girls with long white wings that were attached to their arms, and they were all in white, just floating past It's so sensuous. It is the most brilliant piece. One of the ones that really stand out in my memory as a really, really good and fun piece to watch.
And I know over the years, the language of description for describing drama and comedy and everything else has changed. Has the language for describing dance and ballet changed over the years?
I don't know that it's changed. The big difference is between classical ballet, which has its own language, and you have to find your way around that. You cannot expect an audience to take in the name of every step, and nor should you be describing every step by any means. So that's not what you do. Just occasionally to give the flavour you do. I mean, if it's a classical ballet, you lose the pas-de-châle or the arabesque, where you stand on one leg with one arm in front of you and one arm out at the side and one leg at any height above you until you can tip it forward and your legs are in the splits with the toe pointing to the ceiling, which is a high, high arabesque. But you've told your audience about that. You've described it. They know what that is. So you can put that in every now and again so that they are in that style. Modern dance has no language really, but just the movements that they do. There are certain things that we are very careful about, because dancers themselves have words that they use pejoratively that other people probably don't. And I always describe with a thought for the audience who may well have been dancers, for the audience generally, so they don't get the wrong idea. But I also describe in a way that I would like the dancers themselves to be able to listen and approve of what I do, of what I'm saying. There are no cringe moments, like, waft is one of them, the things that we tend to, please don't say she's wafting, because a dancer doesn't waft. She knows exactly what she's doing and where she's going, even if she is looking ethereal and as if she might blow away any minute. Wafting, it doesn't cover it. And kick is another. Dancers spend years and years and years as children learning that the grand battement, the tossing up of the leg in any direction, comes with a swish from the foot going through the floor and up. Kicking is not what they're doing, and to say that they're kicking when they aren't is ignorance. You just don't do it. And there are other little pitfalls like that. And of course, if you are, like Pippa and Simon, they would never have done that. You don't have to warn them. It's so much easier for them to assimilate the kind of language that you're using into description than it is for a lay person, because you've got to overcome all those don'ts apart from the do's as well. I wish I was special. But I'm a creep. I'm a widow.
Creep by Radiohead there, and that dance piece by Scottish Ballet sounds absolutely amazing. Bridget, for your next track, you've actually chosen a reading by Sir Simon Russell Beale and a Byron poem. I wondered why you've chosen Simon Beale and him reading this particular poem.
Well, Simon, I worked for a long time at the National Theatre describing drama, and I think I must have described Simon, I can't remember how many times. I've done most of his great Shakespearean roles and quite a lot of the others as well. And I even went out when he went with, I think it was Jumpers, to the Piccadilly Theatre, and we described it for him then. And he always comes to the Touch Tour and sits down and talks to the people who've come and will answer questions. And it is just such a beautiful voice, and I would like something from the Drama Times, you know, among my choice, I think. And it brings me back to the fact that your voice is your instrument. And when you're describing dance, I can imagine Simon probably making quite a good dance describer, because he is a trained singer. I think he was at King's College, but he was certainly a chorister and still sings sometimes. And I think he would understand how the voice has to be part of the orchestra when you are describing dance. That as well as not making the dancers cringe, I would want the musicians not to cringe either. And if you are over poetic and sort of, you know, your voice is sort of going on just on a certain note, or if you are strident and not anything to do with the music, it's not singing at all. You don't act and you don't sing, but you just become part of the music, part of the orchestra, and you dance it with the dancers. I mean, the best moments in describing are when you suddenly realize that actually you're almost not there, because you're so part of the performance. It's not you, it's the voice and the music together. And the best moments, so those are the best moments. I remember, I don't think I was aware of this, and perhaps it's a pity I ever was, in a way, because it became a sort of hobby horse, I think. But I do remember after something at Sadler's Wells, I can't remember what it was now, and somebody afterwards said, "You were right on the music, weren't you? Phenomenal." And I suddenly thought, I suppose I was. I was just part of the music, and it blew me away rather. But it made me a bit too conscious of what I was doing for a while. But I think I got back to the sort of just that lovely moment when it's all coming together. And you can't do that if you haven't got total control over your voice. I mean, now I've retired, I don't do the exercises that I used to do, but I think the other reason I've chosen Simon is that he reads poetry. He does read poetry beautifully. But years ago, before I even thought of being an audio describer, I did the gold medal of the Poetry Society in the speaking of verse. And it sounds easy enough, but actually it took me nearly 3 years to get to the final, which is a public performance of three pieces, 10 minutes speaking, three pieces, one long piece and two short ones. Actually, you had to have a distinction. You started with the preparatory exam, and then you went into bronze and silver. And for all those three, you had to have a distinction before you could go on to the next. And took me two goes at each level to get the distinction to go on. I finally got to the final, and I failed that because, and this shows you how long ago it was, the then adjudicator said, "I really wanted to give you this award, but you spoke a Shakespeare sonnet that was written to be spoken by a man, and I can't give it to you. It was a bad choice." Well, of course, that wouldn't happen now. But so I had to have two goes at the gold medal. But I did get it in the end, and I think, I'm so glad. I'm glad in a way it did take me that long, because I learned so much about how the voice speaks from within. From it isn't just sort of off the top of your head any more than dancing is. I mean, we say to a dancer, you don't raise your arms. It doesn't. Where do you think you raise your arms from? And usually they say the shoulder. No, when you raise your arms, you start way below the waist, and so your whole body is in it. And even though it is one simple movement of the arm, it's all of you that's engaged. And it's the same with your voice. You don't just say the words. It's something that comes from the core.
Bridget, I believe you've actually performed this poem too, haven't you?
Yes, that was for the gold medal of the Poetry Society. It was one of the short pieces that I chose for the recital for that.
So we'll go no more a-roving, and the moon still be as bright, for the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul outwears the breast, and the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself have rest, though the night was made for loving.
Sir Simon Russell Beale there, and Lord Byron's poem, So We'll Go No More A-Roving. Bridget, for your next track, it's a track that was performed in a Kanduko dance performance, which I think was choreographed by Irene Phillips. And I wondered, you know, sort of Kanduko Dance Company are a fantastic dance company. And I wondered what it's like actually describing a dance that is performed by disabled dancers, and whether you're focusing on the movements and how much, say, for example, if it's a wheelchair dancer, how much their actual wheelchair or their, you know, sort of their disability comes into it.
Well, it's a bit of a tightrope. I think the best way about it is to ask the dancers what they would like. Mark Brew is a case in point, for instance, who has his own dance company and is in a wheelchair, and I've described him quite often, and he agreed with the two dancers at Kanduko that actually it is part of what they are, and also just how are you going to describe what they're doing if you don't? Sometimes you have to say, you can't say he walks, he wheels, he pushes himself, he twists in his chair, or he gets out of his chair. There's one wonderful moment in Wrap Your Arms Around Me where the girl dancer had a short arm. It ended at the elbow. And they made quite a thing of one moment that the wheelchair was behind a table. And the girl leant on the table with her short arm out. And he slid his arm under hers and wiggled his fingers as if he was wiggling her fingers for her, which was an absolutely beautiful moment. Well, you have to say, short arm, his arm, he wiggles his fingers for her. You know, it's all part of their way of expressing themselves, and it's no different. It's just, well, it's different in what they do, but not in outcome. They are still there to express, in that case, a very close and loving relationship between two people, and they happen to be those two particular people. But you still treat them like the superb dancers that they are. And so disabled people can be just as good dancers as anybody else. But you still have to take into consideration that they are dancing in a wheelchair or with one short arm.
Gareth Dunlop there, and Your Arms Around Me, and a wonderful piece of dance from Kanduko Dance Company, which I must try and find on video if I can, with description. Bridget, now we come to your final track. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
Oh, this is the Polonaise from Sleeping Beauty, the Tchaikovsky. Is one of my favourite bits of all ballet, and in fact of all music, I think. I've actually chosen it for my funeral. But it is the one piece that I really have trouble when I am describing. I almost always have to stop myself from standing up and dancing it with them. And one of my favorite pieces to describe is Matthew Bourne's version of Sleeping Beauty, which is Sleeping Beauty, but with such a twist, with such a lovely, loving little comic twist, that it was a joy, an absolute joy to do. And there were moments that I just used to, you know, that I would look forward all week, because we usually described on a Saturday afternoon wherever they went on tour. And all week I would be waiting for certain little bits that I used to love, absolutely love. His choreography brings out the best in a describer, because there's so much multi-storytelling that goes on while they're dancing, sometimes between characters, sometimes it's going on in the background, but sometimes what's going on in the background is more important than what's going on in front. I suppose you could say that's true quite a lot of times when there's a sort of an ensemble dance, that you have to watch what's going on in the background in case there's storytelling going on, or even a glance. And that happens a lot. And you have to make choices all the time with Matthew Bourne. And often, if you're with a good describer, and there are many that I've worked with, and they will suddenly, sort of 3 weeks into the tour, say, you know, what's going on there is more important than what you're saying. So you have to adjust. But for Sleeping Beauty and the Red Shoes, I did that with Simon, and we went out to the rehearsal studios in outer London for a lot of rehearsals. And so we saw the thing grow, and we heard what dancers were calling little bits, you know, a certain step they would give a name to, so that they knew a little sequence was what they were calling a specific sequence. And so that when we came to, we were part of the performance in a very special way. So we became part of the company and part of the performance, and we could dance it with them, as it were, because we knew it so well. And that's why Simon had actually been with Matthew Bourne's company and danced. He'd actually danced the male swan in Swan Lake, so he knew everybody, and it was like he was back in the company, and I was there becoming part of the company. And that makes such a difference that's the way you should be able to describe. That's what I long for, is a describer who knows about describing, and a dancer who knows about dancing and working together in the company. But it would work for describers who don't know about dancing, would work better if they, or would be better able to describe from the gut, as it were, from the core, if you were part of it, part of the company. And that's the way I would love things to happen, so that you have a collaboration. Yes, wouldn't that be wonderful?
Thank you, Bridget, for sharing your Tracks of My Life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you, Toby. That was lovely. Thank you.